Welcome, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. This is Paul Neifer, your host. And today, we're going to have a conversation with David Muth from, what is it? Okay, David, I've already messed up. What's the technical name of the company?
Yeah, so we operate People's Company Capital Markets.
Okay. Because I was going to say, didn't it used to be alternative something or other? Or am I?
Yeah, Alternative Equity Advisors. Yeah, that's still sort of our separate account product. But we're kind of, as we've got the product matrix set out, we're sort of branding it as People's Company Capital Markets.
Okay, perfect. We've had you on the podcast before, but certainly a lot of things have gone on in the last couple of years since we were on the podcast. But I think before we start talking about some of those changes and trends and so on, for the listeners out there, let's just do a quick background, your background as far as where you're at, where you grew up, college, career, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so I'm a North Central Iowa farm kid, kind of a classic product of the 80s. My parents started the farm from scratch in 1980. Obviously, that created sort of a challenging dynamic where both parents worked off the farm. And so I got shipped off to school like a lot of kids in farm kids in that kind of time frame. Undergraduate, went to Luther College in Northeast Iowa and studied physics and math, and then went on to graduate school at Iowa State and got a master's and PhD in mechanical engineering. Spent a number of years in advanced biofuels, working in the Department of Energy Network of National Labs, 7 years out in Idaho, a year in Washington, D.C. And this was in the George Bush II cellulosic ethanol kind of push. And we built some interesting tech from a data software algorithm standpoint that we ended up rolling into a startup company called AgSolver in Ames in 2013. And we were focused on precision ag for profitability and sort of planning, right? Being able to allocate your working capital at a subfield scale. We would model these things down to a 3-meter, roughly 10-foot scale, and then be able to create plans and understand how to best allocate working capital. We built that company out for 4 years and then exited to EFC Systems, precision ag and ERP software company just outside of Nashville. Spent a little time working with EFC, getting the technology integrated, and then hopped over to work with Steve Brewer, building out our the investment platform, the capital markets platform of People's Company. And so been working on that project here for the last roughly 5 years.
Yeah. And I think the first time you and I met, I think we each were speaking at a farmer event at the casino in near Des Moines. Is that sound right to you?
That is correct. And I'm not going to remember exactly what the name of that event was. But yes, that was absolutely the first time we crossed paths.
Yeah, it's and of course, I was thinking, well, that's just a few years ago. Well, it was probably 8 years ago or something like that. Because COVID is now at least 4 years old, and it was definitely before COVID.
Yes. No, I mean, that is, you're probably right. And unfortunately, 8 years may not even be enough.
Well, this certainly institutional funds have been in existence for a long time in the non-ag area. I mean, we've had mutual funds since the 1920s. We've had, you know, investment partnerships since probably the 1700s and so on. But as far as when it comes to land and so on, institutional ownership, it's been there, but it's maybe not as seasoned as some of those other ones. Let's go through some of the major trends that you're seeing over on the institutional side.
You bet. And I'd point folks to the People's Company website. Some here in the next couple days, there's a nice little white paper that we put together. Steve Brewer put together kind of walking through this history of institutional investment. And it's pretty interesting. And that'll be available on the industry research page on the People's Company website here very shortly. But if we look back, there was a little bit of institutional capital collecting and coming together for farmland in the 90s and kicked off a little bit more earnest in the early 2000s. And then certainly when we went into the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, and you started to effectively see a lot of these long-term fixed income types of products go to zero, right? And you started thinking about quantitative easing and all of the Fed tools that were deployed. Farmland became really appealing for a lot of these funds. And this sort of class of investor that fits into this institutional realm at a very large scale, because it's stable, right? You get some cash yield appreciation drives a long-term outcome. And a lot of funds raised a lot of capital in that time frame. And by and large, you're working on, say, 10 to 15 year funds in a large sense. And you see a lot of those rolling off now. And it's an interesting time where you have opportunities to get better annual cash returns from a number of sort of fixed income outcomes and products than you do in farmland, right?
Yeah.
Certainly, if you look at farmland values in the Corn Belt, 2% cap rates are pretty common. Maybe you can find some 2.5%, and you can go out and get fixed income at 5-6% all day long in really stable products these days. And so we've been hearing both anecdotally and seeing some data that the institutional capital raising has been a little tough, right? It's definitely shifting. That capital stack is moving around a little bit. And the dynamic is really pretty interesting when you look at scale of the institutional. It feels like it's been really impactful. The amount of farmland that they own, these institutional funds and the institutional players, is still relatively small, right? Even at the peaks here in the latest run-up, you know, it's farmers buying 80%+, but it is also regional, right? So you move out into the California and the Central Valley, much, much heavier institutional presence out there. The Delta, where you find larger deal sizes, similar story, a more institutional presence, Pacific Northwest. And, you know, you get into the Midwest and the Northern Plains, certainly you do have corporate farming laws that can be restrictive for some of those folks to participate. And then those highly fragmented ownership, it's harder for them to come in and do deals at the sizes that they'd like to do. So by and large, when we look at it, the institutional players are still mostly active in West, in California, in the PNW, a little bit in the Delta region. But it's still a relatively small percentage.
Well, and I think you're right because I am from the Pacific Northwest, and, you know, you have the permanent crops out there, the apple orchards, the vineyards and so on. And, you know, that capital requirement, I mean, you're talking 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, maybe even 100 million or more, whether you're buying an orchard that's already in production or you're putting, 500 acres into production or 1,000 acres into production, you know, you can easily, like I say, spend 10, 20, 30, 40 million. Whereas in the Midwest, you know, even if you have a large tract, might be 320 acres or 640 acres that comes up, you know, you're still only talking, you know, 4 or 5 million. And like you say, the institutional buyer, that's almost too small for them. Do I have that right, Dave, or not?
Yeah, that's correct. And the specific sizes of deals that they want to play at and are targeting will vary just a little bit, but it starts to get fairly expensive for them to do deals below 10 million in most cases.
Yeah, because they have all the due diligence costs, they have all their overhead, and if you spread that over a $2 million deal, it sort of wipes out the economics for them.
That's absolutely right. Yep. There's a lot of fixed costs associated with getting a deal done, right? A purchase agreement is a purchase agreement, and the legal work that goes into it oftentimes doesn't necessarily scale with the acreage. Yep. And you can start to put some of those other elements in to where it does add up. And 10 million is a little bit of a lower threshold that certainly several that we've worked with have for a check size.
Yeah. And as far as, because you're right. I mean, I've certainly seen a deal where these funds, you know, they have a 7, 10, 15 year window, and that window is expiring and they're out there selling the properties. Now, some of them are what we call an evergreen fund that actually won't expire, or if you have a publicly traded REIT that's out there, but even they have been selling properties off, it appears, over the last 6 months to a year and a half. Is that what you're seeing too?
Yeah, it very much is. The REITs, Farmland Partners and Gladstone, have certainly been having quite a few dispositions. And, one significant element of that is just simply the increase in cost of debt, right? So a lot of the large farmland buyers, institutional types, will use leverage in order to create a higher IRR outcome. And if you go back to when we were really seeing a lot of these funds built, right? The portfolios built, debt was incredibly cheap. Yep. And it fit really well as a complement to enhance overall returns on farmland. And, there's some fixed debt certainly in those portfolios. There's also quite a bit of variable debt that may have a 5-10 year term, et cetera. And then it starts to reset and calibrate, and that changes the cash flow really significantly.
So if they had a 7 year fixed, 25 year AM, 7 year fixed, at the end of that 7 years, they maybe were paying, let's say, in some cases, maybe 2.5-3%. And it's going to reset at 7 or 8 or 9%. And that really changes the dynamics, because the farmland rent hasn't gone up that much.
No, that's exactly right. You're seeing your annual increases in rent. And certainly this commodity price run that we've had in the inflationary period for a few years here is helped on that front. But moving the needle enough to be able to service debt costs that more than double, in some cases, maybe even get close to tripling, that's a dynamic that just doesn't quite cash flow.
Well, I'd eliminate the word quite. It just doesn't cash flow. So makes me happy that on my Missouri ground that I bought a few years back, that's fixed for 20 years. So I don't have to worry about them resetting the interest rate on me. So that's nice. So
absolutely.
Anything else on the institutional side that you want to talk about before we dive off into a couple other subjects?
No, I think that there's certainly a significant infrastructure of institutional farmland investment groups that they're committed to the asset class. They're committed to maintaining their portfolios, and we'll continue to see quite a bit of activity from those folks. But certainly there is a bit of a changing dynamic in the capital stack overall that we can see pretty clearly right now.
And really the trend right now is what, less debt, more equity? Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, there is pretty much all equity deals. And, I would say that our conversations and what we're seeing from a strategy standpoint from these folks, they're really honing in on a couple areas of distress across the country, for particularly certain kinds of crops where that's emerging. Almonds in California are an example. Apples in Washington are another example. And there's at the sort of bottom of the trough on net income from those production systems is where a lot of these folks want to buy. And that seems to be where the focus has really gone.
Okay. Now, one of the trends that we're seeing, and we'll definitely talk about, is the fact that I'm going to use the word maybe non-farm income or net 2.0 or solar or wind. What are the big trends that you're seeing in that area right now?
Yeah, so we've been spending quite a bit of time and energy trying to understand the scenarios around sort of a net zero world and how that impacts farmland. And this fits into a little bit broader theme. We're really seeing emerging revenue streams from our land base, even outside of the ag production, right? And we're kind of trying to get our arms wrapped around the asset management strategies that really get this well positioned, so that over the next 10 to 20 years, when we see expanding revenue, right, from just outside of normal ag production from our farmland, we can make sure that we're capturing that correctly. And the net zero story is a pretty compelling one. And look, we're not trying to make a statement that this is all real and that it plays out, or even arguing that it's rational or not, right, to start to make these investments and move all of the energy production in this arena, we do want to understand what it can look like. And when you play that out and you start to say, okay, net zero by 2050 goals are well established. They're all signed off on in the Paris Agreement, which, you know, depending on the next presidential election, maybe we leave the Paris Agreement again, set the politics to the side. We are seeing over $1 trillion a year globally in investment into this low carbon energy transition. And that's not slowing down. In fact, it's picking up significantly. And China is actually far ahead of the United States in terms of the scale of that investment. And to meet the goals, Bloomberg NEF put out a stat that it really needs to be about $4.3 trillion a year on average through the rest of this decade. And so if we step back and look at what that means for farmland, we're taking our energy production system from highly centralized production facilities, and we have to distribute it, right? That's mm-hmm. the nature of renewables. And a few stats, right? So we've used the Princeton Net Zero America study as just a scenario template to kind of see what this might look like. And a few stats right now, there's, I believe it's about 6,300 wind turbines in the state of Iowa. And if you drive up and down I-35 or east and west across I-80, it doesn't feel like you go very far between wind farms, right? It feels like there's a lot out there right now. In order to meet the production needs for a net zero by 2050, Iowa would have to move from that little over 6,000 turbines up to about 48,000.
Yeah.
And then when you start to apply that to with existing lease rates, with escalators, thinking about, bigger turbines certainly come into the mix and doing some rough analysis, that's almost $1 billion a year in additional revenue back to landowners and from turbines. And yeah. Then you look at how that impacts value, and certain Illinois is a big player there. And the solar story is a little different. Solar is a land use change, right? So when you think about putting solar on, are you really capturing the long-term appreciation that you see in farmland? Probably functions differently, but we don't necessarily know. But the solar acres have to go up a lot, and certainly water-stressed parts of the country, there's a lot of that in California. Not this year. We seem to have broken the drought out there, and water is going to be plentiful. But generally going forward, there's parts of the country where the solar farmland story is pretty compelling. The biofuel story is super interesting too, right? A lot of folks are concerned on the corn side. Hey, the electric vehicle push, what's that going to do to ethanol use? Well, you know, we're at about 17 billion gallons a year capacity with ethanol. And if you look at what we need from a sustainable aviation fuel standpoint, we're seeing some partnerships emerge with ethanol as a hydrocarbon upgraded into sustainable aviation fuel. You know, and that's a big catalyst behind the carbon pipelines to try and reduce the carbon intensity of basic corn-based ethanol to get to SAF. That story is really compelling. And the renewable diesel story is even more compelling, right? 45 billion gallons a year of renewable diesel needed if we believe that our over-the-road truck fleet and our heavy equipment, construction, agricultural, et cetera, is going to continue to use diesel. So we think the biofuel story is positive as well. And then carbon storage is another place where if you look at the potential from some base level practices like no-till and cover crops, you're talking about another $1 billion a year in revenue back to the farmland owners in, say, Illinois and Iowa and a few other prime states.
Well, and you know, I just think about, you know, we've converted some of the cars over to electric, but we really haven't converted any of the semis. Now, maybe there's a few out there, but none of the semi trucks have been converted to electric. None of the tractors have been converted to electric. None of the combines have been converted to electric. And just think about the, and we have AI sucking up energy faster than we can actually put it online. It's the next 10 or 20 years is going to be very interesting.
That's absolutely true. And we'll get a better picture, I think, fairly quickly on, what is the pathway around some of these net zero goals. And we're spending quite a bit of time. It's a little chaotic out there, right? There's
Yeah.
developers that are trying to get land locked up in sort of these long-term development agreements. It'll kick a little bit money back to the farm landowner to essentially hold an option. And the nature of these agreements, it's chaos, right? It's a bit of a
Yep.
race to get land locked up. And we're trying to get that business structured within our energy management group to really be able to help landowners understand what they're looking at, what are the commitments of these agreements, what are the contingencies and the protections that we need to look for, and kind of get a business model in place for helping folks understand and be able to work with these opportunities that are emerging.
Yeah, and that's right, because People Company does have a energy division, don't they? To not just oil and gas, but this other types of alternative energy. That's a resource that's available. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep. We've got our energy management group that'll do traditional oil and gas and mineral management and sales, disposition, selling revenue streams, et cetera. And key focus, though, is really getting a good understanding of the right model to help landowners in this renewable space.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, I have heard now, of course, like you say, this is sort of the wild, wild west. I mean, the numbers, how accurate they are, but easily, 11, well, on the lowest side, I think I've heard is $1,000 an acre, all the way up to maybe $2,500 an acre for solar. Now, that's if it ever goes into production. Right now it's what, maybe $50 an acre up front, or $100 an acre up front to sort of lock in the option. Are those some of the numbers that you're seeing out there, Dave?
Yeah, those are consistent, and you're exactly right. There's certainly a free market element to this, where the revenue streams and the value equations associated with the land in different areas will drive just how high they'll push those numbers. But yeah, you're seeing 1,100 and up, certainly annual lease with escalators, right? With standard escalators built in. Rates on the solar side. And yet you're right, the option, the development option piece, $50 an acre is a starting place there. And it's really interesting. There's a large push, and some of it's with some state incentives stacked on top of the various federal incentives that have worked out, but come out. But Illinois, there's a large push for solar, and you're seeing development contracts being offered on some of the very best of the best on the planet, farm ground. And we've been trying to look at this, and we've got a couple of assets that we've bought for clients where these options, development contracts, have been put in front of us. And you're exactly right, 14, 16, $1,800 an acre is what they're talking about as a starting place on these assets. And the core question is, because it's a fundamental shift in land use, how do you look at the underlying land value where you put solar in place, right? So Illinois farmland is going to be appreciating, depending on how you slice and dice it, roughly 7% a year over the last 30 years. Does that 7% annual appreciation hold on ground that has solar on top of it? We don't know the answer to that.
Yep.
What are we doing in terms of the productivity of that land if the panels come off after a 40-year lease and now it's core farmland again? That's where a pretty detailed discounted cash flow and understanding how much am I really making on that $1,400 an acre lease payment with a 2% escalator if the underlying farmland value doesn't appreciate the way that the rest of that highly productive Illinois farm ground is going to appreciate. That's part of this sort of chaos that I think landowners are kind of having to sort their way through a little bit now.
Or, if all these solar farms go in, I think in Illinois, you're going to end up with about 5 million more sheep, because isn't that what they're using to graze the
Yeah.
grass underneath the solar panels? Is what I'm starting to hear, is they're bringing in more and more sheep because other animals don't work because they'll damage the panels. But sheep seems to be something that works fairly well for them.
That's right. And certainly nobody's trying to sign up more labor to have to go out and do it with a human being. anymore with all of the labor problems that we've got. So, you know, what's that do to the marketplace for sheep?
And it's, you know, when we lived in southeastern Washington, our neighbor would bring in probably 400, 500 sheep on about 50 acres, and there'd be a shepherd there, and there'd be the three or four dogs, because we have definitely mountain lions and wolves in our area. So it was pretty interesting to watch them move the sheep. And believe me, they would, you know, 400 sheep on a 10-acre plot pretty well wipes out the grass pretty quickly.
Yeah, the sheep version of the intensive grazing plans.
Yep. Well, Dave, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break for a sponsor message, and then we'll come back and have a couple more discussions, and then I'll let you go.
How many years away is the long run for a farmer? 5 years? 10 years? Top producers like Hans Reinschi, a Blue Diamond farming company in Jessup, Iowa, know Raboagri Finance shares his enduring vision for the future.
Whether it's building our grain site, or if it's purchasing the next field, we're able to turn to Rabo as a trusted partner to help us get financing to make those generational decisions.
With unmatched financial capacity, local relationship managers, and a global network of sector experts to offer market guidance, Raboagri Finance provides enterprising farmers with a personalized approach to lending and financial services. Growing a better world together. Raboagri Finance.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. This is Paul Neefe, your host, and we're going to rejoin our conversation with Dave Muth from People's Company. Yeah, I already messed it up. People's Company, and not investment. What, a capital? What?
Capital
tell me
markets.
Again what it is, Dave.
Yeah, our Capital Markets Group.
Capital Markets. Okay. You know, if I would write that down, I would remember it. But, you know, I'm not good about writing stuff down. So, you know, the other thing I'd like to discuss with you is that you have sort of partnered up, or People's Company has partnered up with Acre Trader and so on some direct retail, some DST and so on. For the listeners out there, describe what you've done in that area.
Yeah, so Acre Trader, I'm sure a lot of folks have been sort of paying attention to what Acre Trader's done. They've really developed a nice sort of retail investor portfolio. Folks that want to get into farmland, but maybe don't have a lot of tools to be able to get into it. And this kind of goes back to the conversation that we had earlier on the institutionals. Farmland as an investment interest, an investment tool is really pretty compelling, right? It's an inflation hedge, best real asset inflation hedge. It's very, very, very stable in terms of cash yield, zero vacancy, right? You don't have any of those sorts of issues. And the returns are solid from a total return standpoint. And retail investors, so folks that maybe don't have the capacity to go out and buy a farm on their own, that group, that class of investors has had limited tools and products and to be able to access the farmland asset class. And, you know, certainly there's a couple of REITs out there with Farmland Partners and Gladstone. One of the challenges on a REIT is you're taking an asset class that's not correlated with public equities, and you're kind of turning it into a public equity. So there's some tension there in the context of being able to recognize that appreciating value of farmland away from the public equity space and the correlation with inflation. The direct ownership piece is hard, right? You got to have expertise. You got to be able to find deal flow, et cetera. And so Acre Traders built a nice pool of retail investors, and we've partnered with them and done a couple of sponsored offerings on their platform and brought some deal flow to them to be able to do their regular traditional offerings. And then they're our broker dealer for our Delaware Statutory Trust offering that is a portfolio of two farms in Washington State. And I think they're representing a little bit of this movement of retail capital into farmland. And we've gotten really interested in working with registered investment advisors and wealth managers and bank trust departments on creating farmland products that we can offer to them to get the investment performance criteria of farmland available to their clients. And that's been a pretty big push for us here over the last couple of years.
And part of that is, you know, when you're dealing with an RIA or those type of professionals, you do have to register. You got more compliance and due diligence associated with those type of investments. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, you do. And, you know, quick stats. I saw a report. I'm going to forget the exact organization. It's an industry organization. There's a little over 15,000 SEC registered investment advisors, right, that have the certification required. And the crazy part of it is their client base, they collectively have an estimated $114 trillion in assets under management. So it's just a huge, huge, vast pool of capital that certainly some subset being in farmland and having the characteristics of farmland as an investment makes a lot of sense.
I think as you indicated, we're going to see more and more where these RIAs, you know, they want to get a little bit more of an inflation hedge. You know, for the last 20 years or maybe 25 years, until the last couple of years, you know, inflation was something we sort of ignored. You know, we'd been so used to not having inflation. Matter of fact, in the late 2007, 2008, 2009 time period, you know, we probably had deflation. So, you know, this is something that is certainly going to be more top of mind than it was over the last 25 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the stability, right? A lot of folks are seeing signals where we could have a large equity drawback period. Those are periods where farmland does really well too. And so diversification and, you know, the other real asset classes, thinking about multifamily, commercial, industrial types of properties where there are a little bit more robust set of products for that type of investor that are out there, you know, they're not, there's a lot of questioning about whether asset values have inflated too much and what's going to happen just relative to incomes going forward. You've got vacancy concerns, et cetera. And so we definitely see that those fundamental characteristics of farmland are attractive to at least have in the mix for these folks. Yeah.
Well, and the good thing about farmland, you're never going to have a vacancy factor on farmland. I mean, there's always going to be 17 farmers willing to rent your ground. As long as you have good productive farm ground.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, it almost feels like one of those too good to be true comments when you're talking to some of these groups that maybe aren't as familiar with farmland, that zero vacancy is actually a fundamentally real characteristic.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, because have I ever seen farmland where it wasn't being, now I guess you could have like some type of bankruptcy dispute or something like that. But, you know, as a general rule, farmland is always rented or farmed. I mean, that's the reality.
That's 100% correct. And you can go into certain parts of the country where maybe you've got some declining water resources, et cetera. And you can see a drawback on the income that it can generate, but you still have the set of farmers that are going to take it on and make it produce.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Well, Dave, we in our previous podcast, I did ask my four key questions, but I'm not going to do that in this podcast. But I will ask, you've been on the road quite a bit. Do you still have time for some hobbies and time to do spring planting? I'm just curious, you know, what your time looks like.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a stretch here where there's maybe some more road time than you necessarily want, but we're getting everything ready on the farm up in North Central Iowa, ready to go. Mother Nature needs to give us a little bit more of an increase in soil temps. And, you know, honestly, we could use some rain in a little bit. It's very dry up there and through a good chunk of Iowa, really. And so we need to see Mother Nature cooperate, but in order to get started, but we're getting close, right? I just this morning on my drive in, I saw some tillage equipment rolling down here in central Iowa. So we know that's coming around the corner, and it's going to be a little bit tricky to find time to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hear that you might be having some 70s, but I also hear there might be a potential big rain / snow event that may come close to you next week. Is that right?
That's what it looks like. Yeah, it's looks like it's going to be a nice day today, although a few clouds are rolling in. But we're sort of behind on soil temps. I know last year we had did our early soybeans on April 14th, so a few days ahead of where we're at now, and we will not be doing anything that soon this year, that's for sure.
Well, the good news, at least for me, is out in my farm in Washington State last year, the rain stopped on like February 1st and didn't show up until after Labor Day. This year we've had rain, and my app that tells me when I have rain showed that we had like a quarter inch or half inch of rain last week. And for that part of the neck of the woods, that's a good amount of rainfall.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely could use some rain. It wouldn't hurt us at all from a timing, but we do need those temps to stay a little higher.
Well, Dave, thanks a lot for taking time out of your schedule to be on the podcast. And I'm sure I'll be catching up in another year or so with another podcast with you.
Always fun. Always appreciate the conversation, Paul.
Okay. Again, this is the Top Producer Podcast, and this is Paul Neefe, your host, signing off.